Hey everybody, welcome to episode 22 of CreateCast, the show about people who make good. I'm your host, Chase Kay. This week's guest is Joanna Demers. She is an author and also the associate professor and chair of musicology at the University of Southern California. She's sort of known around campus for teaching a class on hip-hop, which is how I was first introduced to her. She's insanely brilliant, a great writer, and a great teacher, and it was really kind of her to sit down with us. So a really fun interview. We talk about sort of her early intellectual influences, how she got into music, how she got into writing, and just sort of the writing process. And then we also talk about her new book, Drone and Apocalypse, which is really, really fascinating. So we get into all of that in the interview. As always, make sure you visit us at createcastpod.com to find out more about our guests, see some behind-the-scenes photos, and all that good stuff. And you know what? That's it. So without any further ado, here's this week's episode with Joanna Demers. All right. Hey, everybody. We're sitting down with Joanna Demers. She is the chair of musicology here at the University of Southern California and also the author of an upcoming book, Drone and Apocalypse, coming out this December. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Well, thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
So talk to me a little bit about how you first sort of got into musicology, because I think often people hear maybe about how people become musicians, but I think musicology is a little bit more vague for some people. So maybe you just explain a bit about how you got interested.
Sure. Okay, so I was a music major at UC San Diego, also pre-med major. I was going to double major. I was playing flute, and one of the requirements of the music major was to take a music history class, a survey of everything from medieval to present Western classical music. And the teacher who taught it was just the most engaging, interesting person I'd ever heard. He has this knack. His name is Mitchell Morris. Now he's a senior professor at UCLA's Department of Musicology. And he has this knack for really being able to make anything interesting. And it was long about the fourth week of his class on medieval music that I very, very shyly came up to him after class and just sort of asked him, well, how do you get the job that you have? You get to talk about music for a living.
Yeah.
And it was very inspiring and very encouraging. And he told me about graduate school in musicology, and that was it.
That's incredible. I think that it's, you hear that story a lot. It's people have one teacher who really just sort of inspires them and you know, shows them. And oftentimes I think it's even with people who don't maybe end up going into a specific field.
Mm-hmm.
I just interviewed a historian who was also one of my high school professors. And I'm obviously not a historian. I'm a musician. But at the same time, it was just such an incredibly engaging class. And I was able to learn so much and get so much out of it. So that's really wonderful that you had that experience. I am curious, though, so if you were studying flute and pre-med, how was sort of the conversation with your parents, or just saying, all right, this is what I'm going to do? Was that an easy transition, or was that a little bit difficult?
Well, to their credit, they're very loving parents, and they ended up supporting me. They had questions. You know,
mm-hmm.
my parents are both products of the Great Depression,
mm-hmm.
and my father is an electrical engineer. He encouraged me initially to go into science or medicine because that's what one did growing up in that generation. And no one in my family had heard of musicology. Music, of course, is a dicey prospect. But, you know, I explained to them if I worked very hard and if I was very, very lucky, there might be an opportunity to become a professor at the end of that. And they warmed to it.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. My brother and I are the same way, just very artistically leaning. Whereas my father's, but I come from a long line of attorneys,
oh.
So it's sort of like breaking that pattern is a little bit interesting. But you know, luckily I come from a very similar family. You know, just incredibly supportive and just, you know, it's so wonderful to be able to engage with this medium because it really does speak to so many different areas of life. I mean, it's sort of I think you know similar to food in that way where it's you know. Everybody has music. Every culture has music. One thing that was really interesting about you know just your work and reading some of your research was you seem to have, much like myself, just very eclectic musical tastes, you know, just very diverse. So talk to me a little bit about sort of the diversity of your studies.
Oh, I went to such a special place as an undergrad at UCSD. I started as a freshman, I think maybe 6 weeks after John Cage had just passed away. And the Department of Music there has a very long, great reputation for composition and for new music performance. So extended techniques, experimental practices, very difficult music to practice and to perform. The faculty there was phenomenal in the sense that they were not interested in just studying one particular type of music. Yeah. And to be honest, the graduate students there were even better. I had my very first music seminar as a freshman was on John Cage, but we had this whole kind of collection of different TAs who were making very, very compelling arguments linking Madonna to experimental theater to Darmstadt new music, and it all kind of made sense because there was never the sense that we were forced to take one type of music seriously and discount the others.
You know, it's really interesting. I feel like sometimes certain disciplines get caught in their ivory tower, and I think classical music to a certain extent can have that. But I think it's really wonderful to sort of hear that they were really open to those different disciplines and also those different interests. Especially, I mean, just for myself, often I find that if I don't like a piece of music, it's maybe to a certain extent because I don't understand it. Mm-hmm. And trying to understand it more, I think I can find, a lot of parallels. And especially now, I find that the more music I listen to, I find that I have to listen to more interesting stuff. The stuff I write is very pop, but when I listen to music, I try and listen to things that, world music or things that are in other languages because I can't understand it.
Yeah.
So it's more difficult for me to analyze.
That's a great point.
So you talk a lot about drone music, obviously, in some of your research. How did you start? I think that's sort of, I often hear about, musicians. It's either musicians who are into drone music or people who do yoga. But oftentimes, I think there's really, I really love drone music, and I think there's this opportunity for a wider audience. Why do you think maybe more people are sort of resistant? Because it seems like it's something that could be much more popular than it is.
Well, I think a lot of people don't realize how popular it is. I mean, okay, the number of people who go out actively to a drone music festival or concert are few. But all of us watch movies that have drones in it, and we're not aware of it because it's very successful as background music. You're right, there's the yoga class effect. So a lot of people are ingesting it, so to speak, in other ways. And, at this point where we are in the beginning of the 21st century, some forms of organized religion are waning in influence, others are gaining in influence. But I think for those who have more of a secular mindset, we still see instances where people are looking for some sort of communal experience like a ritual, even though they might not be religiously inclined. So drone can appeal to that group of people.
Well, and obviously, drone just being part of the title of your upcoming book, how and just from what I was reading about it, obviously, I haven't been able to read it yet, it's not out, but talk to me a little bit about how drone music, in your eyes, relates to sort of, apocalyptic artwork and that whole concept of, the end of the world. How does that all tie in?
Well, it's been in the air a lot, and there have been some really important recordings in the past 15 or 20 years that have kind of aligned drone with apocalypse. And one of the better ones is William Basinski's Disintegration Loops, which was a series of ambient drone works that he was already working on and had kind of finalized right when the attacks on September 11th happened. And Basinski very consciously took photos that he had taken of the Manhattan skyline throughout the course of that day, because he lived in Brooklyn at the time. He took photos of that and made those the four album covers of the drone works that he had released. So that album goes on to get Pitchfork's highest accolade in 2001 when it comes out. And then when they do a 10-year retrospective later of the whole decade, they say that this is one of the most important recordings. And you have other artists like... there's a wonderful French musician named Eliane Radigue who's been doing drones since the 70s. Often with titles that refer to death or that refer to some sort of after-death spiritual experience. For her, her practice is Tibetan Buddhism. So these are things that were already kind of out there, and I, rather than making a constellation, I was basically just making a list of all of the connections that other people had already made. And it's an unfortunate coincidence that right now the number one association that people have when they hear the word drone has nothing to do with music.
Yeah.
And that had nothing to do with me.
Or it's just going to sell more books.
Yeah, well. But it seems to be that when you have music that seems, for the most part, not to change very much and just to stretch on for long periods of time, that coincides with a lot of people's view of what eternity is or what the end of time is.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing that sort of got me thinking when I was just reading through information about the book was just how much art is inspired by the apocalypse and just apocalyptic ideas, in spite of the fact that it seems to not really be on its way too soon,
yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I mean, art for centuries has taken that as an influence. In what way does that tie into the work?
That's a great point. Yeah, my work is, if you will, it's a work of creative nonfiction. So I'm not writing a scholarly work. I'm writing a pretend exhibit catalog for an art show that happens in the future. And what people are thinking, what people are very interested about in the future is the fact that our time in the early 21st century is so fascinated with apocalypse. We're all convinced it's coming. We all think this is the end. They think that's kind of funny. And so they decide to make a retrospective of all of these apocalyptic tendencies. And they have the benefit of the future in that they can laugh and say, well, we didn't die yet.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to be a Pollyanna and say that there are no problems in the world, but you're right. I mean, this seems to be a human trait. We always think that we're...
The end is nigh.
The end is nigh. Yeah.
It's just fascinating. And the other thing that really struck me is the sort of lead character, I guess you could call her, is... at one point it talks about her making conceptual artworks that never actually get made. And I was actually having a discussion just the other day talking about someone, whether or not an idea itself can be art.
Yeah.
What do you think about that? And just to sort of throw my two cents in, it was sort of having the idea of I miss home is not itself art. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if the idea of that idea...
Right.
Is art, because it sort of evokes a specific feeling, you know?
Yeah, well, these are great questions, and, you know, the 20th century is just full of people who, at times, independently come up with this idea of the dematerialized artwork. So Fluxus musicians, Fluxus artists are coming up with descriptions of artworks, written descriptions, and they're never realized, they're never made. They're kind of whimsical, at times almost humorous. But we've had this idea with us for a very long time. I mean, when you look at a music score, for instance, obviously that's a work of art, right?
Mm-hmm.
Need that score be performed for it to count more?
Yeah.
In some cases, yes, but in other cases, no. Same thing for architectural plans. You know, the definition of art has been blown so wide open.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's just a really fascinating question. I'm not sure it's... Obviously, it doesn't really have an answer, but it's just sort of fun to ponder. I want to get into a little bit... Obviously, at USC, you're really known for your hip-hop class.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when people hear hip-hop and university together, they say, what?
Nah.
It's yeah. one of those things that they sort of, it's hard to wrap your mind around, but it's also really cool to see, just like we were talking about earlier with, you know, sort of this multidisciplinary approach, this sort of acceptance of all musical cultures. Mm-hmm. How did you get interested in hip-hop? I mean, again, like I said, sort of like me, very eclectic taste from drone mm-hmm. music to hip-hop, that's sort of a big leap.
Right.
So how did we get there?
Well, I did not grow up listening to it. In my college years, was getting really interested in 70s funk and blaxploitation film soundtracks.
Mm-hmm.
That was the hook for me, because I started hearing some of that music sampled in hip-hop. Dr. Dre's The Chronic was mm-hmm. really an important album for me, even though initially I didn't think I liked it. I was...
Mm-hmm.
Kind of coming with these naive ideals of feminism, and so I thought hip-hop equals bad.
Mm.
But the musical processes and the hip-hop's habit of quoting, of sampling, were really interesting to me, and then I started listening to it and
yeah.
got really into the humor. And
You know, it's interesting. I find that sometimes with myself, I need to be, you know, in a specific mindset to enjoy a specific piece of music. So the first time that I heard A Tribe Called Quest, Midnight Marauders, mm-hmm. I didn't like it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then I had this moment where I turned it on, and it was the greatest album I had ever heard. It was just magic. And I think that's so interesting that sort of just your perspective can change.
Oh, yeah.
On you know, whether it's music or artwork or other pieces. But you know, that's just really fascinating. Talk to me a little bit about hip-hop just sort of as a musical movement in comparison with other music, because I think that there's something sort of inherently different about the way that hip-hop has sort of become a part of our culture.
Right, yeah. I think it's had the most sustained relevance as a social movement. Mm-hmm. Other forms of popular music in the 20th century were edgy and then were very quickly co-opted into commercialism. Hip-hop obviously has been co-opted into commercialism too, but no one today, for instance, thinks, I'm going to go out and make my parents angry, I'm going to play rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
You know, jazz used to be that type of music, not anymore.
Yeah.
You know, the hotbed of jazz activity in this country is the university and the conservatory. Hip-hop still seems to have that kernel of resistance, all of the, you know, connections with industry notwithstanding.
Do you think that's going away, or do you think that there's something inherent to the medium that sort of... Because I wonder, because one thing that perhaps will stay true about it is the existence of, you know, sort of the hip-hop underground, and
yes.
how there are a lot of independent artists making hip-hop, and that mm-hmm. sort of makes me wonder, because... I think to a certain extent there is that with rock and roll, but oftentimes I feel like it's more of a gimmick than it is an actual identity. But
yeah.
the hip-hop underground feels like something a little bit more real.
Yeah, and I think it's real only because of the numbers of people around the world who regard it as real. When you hear hip-hop in countries where English is mm-hmm. not the native language... when you hear people in their own native languages emulating the cadence of American rappers, that's proof that something for them in their own cultural context also means resistance, mm-hmm. rebellion. Nothing lasts forever, and eventually I think, you know, maybe our grandchildren or our great-grandchildren will think, oh, how quaint, hip-hop. But for now, it still seems, it has a poetic presence in addition to just being kind of a musical style.
Yeah,
so,
I'm curious. What are you listening to these days? What sort of is capturing your attention?
Oddly enough, I just because I'm not teaching the hip hop course right now, I'm teaching a course on British popular music since 1970.
Mm.
So I'm turning back to music that is more familiar to me, but I'm discovering these jewels all the time that
mm-hmm.
I passed up the first time. So there's this great British band called Kitchens of Distinction.
It's a great band name.
Yeah, yeah. They were big, like, the end of the 80s, 90s, kind of jangly guitar rock. What else? I am very, very, very much in love with Scott Walker. Not the politician, the great musician. He was a singer who, American-born, moved to London in the mid-60s to avoid the draft, was wildly popular. He was considered to be kind of the heir apparent to Frank Sinatra. He had that type of voice. Wow. Just an incredible instrument. Did a lot of middle-of-the-road pop. And then in the 70s, he kind of had a burnout. Became an alcoholic, cut down on the recording, but from time to time released these very strange kind of experimental records that everyone who is anyone in British popular music thought were genius. So if you look at Eno, if you look at Bowie, if you look at the members of Radiohead, all of them can agree on one thing, that Scott Walker is the basis of their career.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Well, again, this has been a really fun conversation. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Once again, a huge thanks to Joanna for coming on the show. Really fun interview, and maybe we'll get her back on sometime. As always, make sure you visit us at createcastpod.com to see all sorts of behind-the-scenes info. You can sign up for our email newsletter. And also make sure you visit us in iTunes. So, just go into the store, search CreateCast, leave us a review, see all of our previous episodes with tons of incredible guests. If you haven't, go back and listen to some of the cool people that we've talked to, and other awesome people coming up. So make sure you stay tuned, hit that subscribe button, and wait for more. Alright, once again, I'm your host, Chase Kay, and remember, make good.